I have things about high platforms. I don't think in the Vinaya it says that we shouldn't be on high platforms, but this does feel rather high. But I also know it's really important if you have something to say that you're heard. So it's absolutely magnificent. I hadn't seen it before, but it's a wonderful thing that's been built for these sorts of events. So thanks very much, Shanta City. I didn't know it was you that had one of the jobs of putting the Buddhas under the trees, but I actually will mention them further on here at Wyndham. So I'm quite daunted by this task. To speak of the Buddha is to attempt to speak of the inconceivable, the ineffable. And of course, it means that I will have to speak from faith. And I have lived with, I realise now, a very comfortable, fixed view that yes, you know, the three jewels are wonderful, but I'm a doctrine follower. And it was the Dharma that drew me to the three jewels. And I realise, as an ex-academic, as somebody who was excited by ideas, I sort of went with some habitual tendencies. And faith was something that, you know, it wasn't very concrete. And what did any of us mean by faith? So this is going to have to be from faith. I've consulted no books, and those who know me know that that's an amazing thing. You know, at the moment I'm asked to do something, well, where are the books that will help me? I was already in England when I was asked to do this, and of course there were books available. I was staying with a Mitra friend, and she has a good library, and I did go and pull a whole lot of books off her shelves, but I have to say I didn't actually open one of them. It was very comforting to have them there. So the only things that I consulted, of course, are Puja book for the Vandana, the Buddha Vandana itself. And I did remember that in Ratnaguna's wonderful book, The Art of Reflection, he had used a translation by Thanissara. So I did actually go and look at that, and I will offer you that at some stage. But basically, this is a very personal talk. And it does feel like the next step. I've so appreciated the two talks that have preceded this one. And I realise that being asked to do this talk has shown me what the next step is for me. I'm somebody that perhaps, you know, it's good fortune, but of course it has its downside, who can keep herself in pretty positive mental states most of the time. And I have the good fortune never to have to do something that I don't want to do. I don't have to work for a living. In the ordinary, you know, paid workforce. And so what I do are the things that I really want to do. So there's a seamlessness in my life that I really appreciate. But I realise that I can just cruise, that where's the cutting edge? So, you know, there's always a cutting edge in chapter and at a centre. I do what I can at the Sydney Buddhist Centre in terms of teaching and retreats and things like that. And there are always edges there, but, you know, what's the long term? What's the major next step? And I can see that it's going to be a practice of always having something a bit more challenging than the day-to-day challenges of Dharma and Sangha. And so that, and of course there will be Dharma and Sangha that I will be working with. But just being more conscious that I need to be putting those things in place. So being asked to give this talk and accepting to do so has had a galvanizing effect on my whole practice, and particularly my meditation, especially my not very formal visualization practice. So I am most grateful for what this opportunity has given rise to, and I still feel daunted. So I want to dedicate this talk to Bhante Sangharajita and to Subhuti and to all those in the order who have responded and become part of what for me has been the most amazing conversation, dialogue about the Buddha and reimagining the Buddha. So I dedicate my talk to So here goes. I want to start by reading the English translation of the Buddha Vandana, of the Tiratna Vandana, which Akash Ashuri read so beautifully this morning. But I thought, well, perhaps we could just have that reading again and again for the next 40 minutes. But perhaps that wouldn't be quite what Parami intended. So I will be using the translation from our own puja book. But I have, in two places, used my preference of words rather than those in the puja book, although they're words that are used in other translations. And I will include the English translation of the final lines that we've been haltingly learning that are always chanted in India. Homage to him, the blessed one, the worthy one, the perfectly enlightened one. Such indeed is he, the richly endowed, the free, the fully and perfectly awake, equipped with knowledge and practice, the happily attained, knower of the worlds, guide unsurpassed to humans to be tamed, the teachers of gods and men, the awakened one richly endowed. All my life I go for refuge to the awakened one, to the Buddha, to all the awakened of the past, to all the awakened yet to be, to all the awakened that now are. My worship flows unceasingly. No other refuge than the Buddha. Refuge supreme is there for me. Oh, by the virtue of this truth, may grace abound and victory. I bow my head to the dust on the feet of the peerless Buddha. However I have erred in relation to him, may I be forgiven for that fault. So now I just read to you Bhikkhu Thanissaro's translation, and this is a translation just of the central Buddha Vandana verse. Indeed, the Blessed One is worthy and rightly self-awakened, consummate in knowledge and conduct, well gone, knower of the cosmos, unexcelled trainer of those who can be tamed, teacher of devas and human beings, awakened, blessed. In the translation we are most familiar with, the central verse begins and ends with richly endowed, and the phrase reappears in the Dharma and Sangha Vandanas. So just briefly, I want to explore some of the phrases, the qualities and endowments of the Buddha, which are offered to us in the canonical literature. And the first one I can do little more than just say, the Blessed One. The Free. Free from what? So for me, a reflection can come with the free. Free from greed, hatred, and delusion. Free from birth and death. And then getting very much more personal. Free from all conditioning, distractions, mental proliferations, opinions, comparisons. Free from the gravitational pull of samsara. Kinesthetically, how does the idea or word free feel in our bodies? The taste of freedom. The colour of freedom. The sound or the silence of freedom. properly attained. And in both the Dharma and the Sangha, Vandana talks, happily or happy has been very strongly there. And it's a combination of words that I really love, happily attained. So it's not the happy, for me, that would rapidly turn into the happy clappy, but it's the attainment of enlightenment that is happy, that is joyful, that is blissful. And Parami talked of the Sangha as happily, happily perceiving. So it's not that it's a great grudge. And there was a lovely image in yesterday's talk of it being the Dharma being a butterfly, not a bird of prey or a bird of doom. And so that sense that there is a great lightness, there is a great joy in the enlightened state. For me, Thanissaro is well gone, doesn't have the same resonance at all. Guide unsurpassed of men in our translation, but I did change it to humans. Guide unsurpassed of humans to be tamed. And there, many things speak to me, but particularly in our translation, the word guide. Thanissaro uses unexcelled trainer. And for me, guide really resonates. Someone who knows and shows the way. But each one of us has to consciously receive and accept the guidance and put it into practice. And there was a lovely quote in Vajratara's talk yesterday of the Buddha saying to somebody, no, I can't do that for you. I can guide, I can show you the way. But we, each one of us, have to be able to put it into practice. So Thanissaro's translation of this one was unexcelled trainer of those who can be tamed. And my old academic mind thought, goodness, is Thanissaro saying that there are some humans that can't be tamed? And then I realised I was being literal yet again, that he'd actually used the word those. So he's suggesting that the Blessed One can, you know, there are many sentient beings, the Blessed One was able to tame or can tame. So it suggests much more than humans. So it's not only the likes of Angulimala and some of those other wonderful stories that we have in the Pali Canon, but we also have the Buddha deciding that things had got so fractious that he was just going to go and spend some quiet time in the forest. And lo and behold, he and the king of the elephants, who's suffering similarly from his following, live together in the forest. And of course there's the wonderful story of Devadatta's attempt to inflict harm or perhaps even kill the Buddha by getting an elephant drunk and then provoking the elephant with goads and loud noises. And as the elephant thundered down an alleyway that the Buddha was in, the Buddha was able to tame that being so desperately upset. So yes, a guide for those who can be tamed. And then in the final part of the Buddha Vandana, which is repeated in all three Vandanas, is the lovely phrase, may grace abound and victory. And Adisthana is a term that I have always found enormously inspiring, positive. It certainly has resonated with me. And grace is one of the ways that Adisthana can be translated. So for me, it has no Christian overtones. I know that some people, depending on your background and training, it may have. For me, it doesn't. And it's like blessed. To be full of grace would be to be blessed with grace. And the idea that comes from Tibetan traditions of grace waves, that not only are such beings, both bodhisattvas and Buddhas, blessed and full of grace, that those blessings and that grace flow from them towards all sentient beings. So it does The lines chanted always in India have no canonical counterparts, but I very much appreciate the strong confessional aspect of each of those verses, which we are becoming more familiar with, as well as the continued devotion that the one for the Buddha, and it's something I will come back to, but it's the dust. I bow my head to the dust on the feet of the peerless Buddha. And so there's a great sense of devotion there, as well as confession. And I don't know where they come from. I did ask Yanashuri if she knew, and neither of us know. Perhaps somebody here does. But we just wondered whether they might come from Dr. Ambedkar, whether they came from him. The repetition of the phrase richly endowed, I believe, gives us permission, if we need it, to come up with our own qualities, our own sense of the endowments and aspects of the Buddha. We need not be, in fact, I don't believe we can be, restricted by what's offered to us in the canonical literature. And even if we looked at the whole of the canonical literature, not just the Pali Canon, of course there's a great deal there. Because, of course, the Mahayana didn't feel at all restricted by something like the Buddha Vandana. And they certainly went on and on, one might say, with pages and pages of the Buddha's qualities. There were oceans of virtues, more than the sands of innumerable Ganges, greater than the numerous Mount Sumus, coties and coties of qualities. And now we ourselves, as 21st century practitioners, need to find those qualities that speak to us and offer and reflect on them. Many of the qualities offered in the Buddha Vandana don't resonate strongly with me. Some of them are so large, fully and perfectly awake, and I'm left, you know, beloved sounds left in shunyata, but I'm just sort of left in a gripping blank. So that, you know, qualities like that I need to unpack. However, there are many qualities in the canonical literature that do, I think, speak more strongly. To start with, the qualities of the 10 precepts, mostly from the positive formulations, speak immediately and inspiringly, and perhaps just a little bit closer. They don't seem to be so enormous, so overwhelming as perfect enlightenment can do. And of course, these qualities, which for us are training precepts, describe in part the spontaneous conduct of the enlightened one, of a Buddha. So I'm perfectly aware that as we say them, we are saying them as training principles. But of course, what we're aspiring to is the spontaneous conduct of an enlightened one. So we have deeds of loving kindness, open-handed generosity. And for me, not taking the not given is actually one of the negative formulations that I find very inspiring indeed. It has a breadth about it and includes so much more than anything material that one does speak to me. We have stillness, simplicity and contentment. Truthful, kindly speech, helpful and harmonizing. And we have tranquility, compassion, and wisdom. And from the Dharmapada, and I didn't go back and consult it, but the one that just leapt to my heart and mind as I was thinking about this talk was the phrase, the trackless one. And I had the good fortune to be at Vajraloka just before coming here on the convention, and with Carmela Sheila looking at sadhana. So the serendipity for me of these things has been amazing. And for me, I'm not a bird person. I don't know whether they were eagles or hawks, but I'll call them eagles. The Vajraloka eagles for me have the feel, the sight, and the taste of freedom. And they were on the airwaves many afternoons and just gliding and soaring and then swooping. And they were just beautiful. And the phrase, the trackless one, came to heart and mind. And then, of course, we have so many incidents in the Pali Canon, so many little stories. And just seeing the way the Buddha responded, I mean, gives us such a glimpse of the qualities with which he is endowed. And I just mentioned the ones that came most rapidly to my own mind. But Kissa Gotami, the way he responded to a mother in such distress. And then Magia. I just think it's wonderful that Magia finally, you know, years you can go to the mango grove, and when he comes back and talks about thoughts lustful and thoughts whatever, you know, the Buddha doesn't say, well, heavens above, what did you expect, and I all but told you so. He just gives Magia the most wonderful teaching. And I know that response of, well, what would you expect? You know, I tried to tell you something, do something more sensible. Doesn't ever help. I mean, the person will, it's much more likely than just to sort of think, I'm bothered. That's one that I particularly like. And then there's the case of dysentery and the fact that the Buddha doesn't ask somebody else to help the sick monk and clean him up. He and Ananda do it together. And then he speaks with the monk and finds out what's happened for the monk himself. And then he goes and speaks with the other bhikkhus. And again, he doesn't rant and rave, but he just points out, when you've given up your biological family, then we know we're family to one another. And finally, I love the fact that the Buddha, in his last hours, had a message sent back to Kunda, the blacksmith, who had given him his last meal, to say it's a very meritorious, it's a very honourable thing to have given an enlightened one his last meal, clearly concerned that Kunda would feel, in Christian terms, guilt-stricken, that perhaps something that he had given the Buddha had caused his biological death. And there's a real sense there of a real sensitivity and trying to make it as easy as possible for Kunda in coming months. And I'm sure for all of us, different stories will come to mind. I had a lovely time asking some of the Dharmacharini who were on the retreat that we were on at Vajraloka, if asked what phrase would come to you if you were going to read a reflection on the Buddha. And the responses were lovely, but Ananda, he was so kind, was there. And another one that's a favourite of mine was, I have stopped Angulimala. So it was lovely, and I'm sure that you'll all have those. And I just ask you, if you can, to hold them in heart and mind, as we're trying to hold the Buddha in heart and mind throughout the day. And there will be a period at the end of the reflection, I'll have at least 10 minutes, where I'm just going to leave it open. It feels, very selfish of me to offer all of the epithets or phrases that work for me, when I know that we all have particular ones. So I do hope that will work for you. So I now go on to a very much more personal reflection. Almost 11 years ago, I asked for the Buddha Shakyamuni as my sadhana practice. And it was a choice which came to me only days before my private ordination. But it is a choice which has grown more and more part of me over the years. With my deepening practice and understanding of what going for refuge might mean, or does mean. And for me, ethics has always been a very strong part of my practice. It was one of the things that really drew me to the Dharma, was the Buddhist preceptual base. And I suppose more and more I've recognized that in their perfected form, in the positive formulations, we are offered all a number of aspects of the enlightened mind that's spontaneous and natural. So we're training ourselves in that direction. But for the enlightened mind, the positive qualities that we chant are there. And I suppose over the years, a sense of bond with the Buddha Shakyamuni has developed, Samaya. And Kamala Shiva spoke about the bond that we all carry with us, that is with us, it's not carried, on the sadhana retreat. And he was referring in part to what brought us to the Dharma, what was it that we actually heard the Dharma when we came across it, that there's something there even before we might have a constructed form, set of concepts and words that we can give some understanding to it. And as I've looked over my life, I didn't find the Dharma in a way I could hear it until my 40s. And yet I can look back, and there were moments, and I will mention one of them later, when I can see that there was this resonance. I love Bhante's quote, and I don't have it, but the ultimate resonates within us, or our resonance with the ultimate. Yeah, it comes from within us, and I can see that there were glimpses, there were flashes of that at times. And I have been on a pilgrimage over the period of time that I've been in touch with the Dharma. I went on pilgrimage with Magar in 1996. I was a mitra at that time. And it wasn't one that was organised by the wonderful people who are now doing very much more organised pilgrimages to India. But we got to the four of the five places that the Buddha himself said should become places of pilgrimage. The one we didn't get to was Lumbini. But the place that spoke to me most was Shravasti. And it was partly, there was very much fewer tourists there. The big buses didn't arrive in. There was one government tourist bungalow, but it wasn't open. So if you wanted to stay at Travesty, you had to find a monastery that would take you in. This was when we were there in 96. It could easily have changed now. And the Ceylonese monks had a visitor's room and were prepared to take us in. And I just found Travesty amazing. We were able to sit behind a group of monks at the Gandakuti. And they chanted the refuges and precepts in ways that were understandable to us, and we were able to join them and sit there in that meditation. And I've always loved the story of Anathapindika when he goes to his brother-in-law and he finds out why his brother-in-law is so busy. And it's not a marriage, it's because the Buddha is coming for a meal the next day. And Anathapindika just says, "Buddha? Buddha?" And then I'm sure you all know the story, but there at Travesty is the park that he laid the gold coins out for to buy from the prince owner. And of course I have worked in India since I became ordained, and there's been a real sense of I am sort of somehow on the same earth, as it were, the same dust. And it's at times been wonderful to think, well, what would it have been like 2,500 years ago? The environment, of course, it would have been very different. But one thing I'm sure of is it would have been dusty by the end of the hot season. So that the dust at the Buddha's feet is something that really speaks to me. And sure, I had a lot of dust on my own feet much of the time. And then we had the international convention there in 2009. And I had been to Bodh Gaya before, but not as a Buddhist. And it was just amazing to sit under the Bodhi tree there and with so many of us all there together. Most recently, through Bhante and Subhuti and a host of experienced order members, the focus on the fundamentals and central significance of the Buddha Shakyamuni has been re-emphasized, sharpened, and refocused. These offerings, both verbal and written, these reflections, and I think particularly of Ratnaguna's chapter in his book, and the biographical explorations, and I think of Vishvapani and his wonderful biography, have felt like riches, have felt like blessings poured upon me. And I imagine for many of us who have the Buddha Shakyamuni as our sadhana, you know, these discussions haven't raised sort of central doubts or any sort of doubt about the sadhana we're doing, of course. But it just felt for me like all these people putting their hearts and minds towards the Buddha have been such a blessing to me. So what follows now are just some glimpses of my responses, and their responses to Bhante, Sangharakshita and Subhuti's reimagining the Buddha. And in that paper, they start, or early on, they talk about the need for an empathy for life, and other ways that's talked about is in harmony with nature, having a faith or a belief in a living world. For me, this flows directly and deeply out of and into eminence, the potential for Buddhahood that is alive and there throughout the world. And I don't want to go on and talk in any conceptual way about eminence, about Tathagatagarbha, Buddha nature, but just a sense that it's very much bigger than the human world, and it's there. Within months of finding the Dharma and the FWBO, as it then was, in 1990, I was on a retreat. It wasn't my first one, but I think it was only the second. And I was sitting on a veranda of what is now Vijayaloka, the Sydney Buddhist Centre's retreat centre, just outside the city. It was just after an early morning double sit, and I was writing my meditation journal. And there was a strong sense of failure. The distractions were numerous, as it felt always, they were numerous. And I just sort of was feeling pretty low. And it was also raining, which it does do in Australia now and again. And it was raining. And if I have a tendency, it's to hate a damp, moist, rather smelly bath towel. And so there I was thinking, oh, my bath towel won't dry, and blah, blah, blah. So I was really in the gravitational pull, I can tell you. And I looked up, and there was the most magnificent flame tree in full flower. And I can't describe the experience, but suddenly all those, the sense of failure, the damp towel, all those things just fell away. And there was a great sense of peace and contentment and a sense of this is absolutely the right place to be. And that evening, we were asked to bring one of Bhante's poems. It was a woman's retreat, but clearly for anybody that was associated with the centre, any woman associated. Centre, and I didn't know Bhante's poetry, and I don't know which one I chose, but somebody else chose Bhante's Sangharakshita's poem Maitreya, and for me it put my morning's experience into a context. Maitreya, and this is Bhante in Kalimpong, of course. So, Maitreya. Lost in these yellowing autumn woods, I see a Buddha seated under every tree. Each white peak and each dark violet hill seem a giant Buddha meditating still. So poised this earth, so calm its sky above, they seem like Maitreya, deep in thoughts of love. And I hope you can see what might have gone on for me having heard that. But it's meant that I have never forgotten that experience. If I'd just had the experience knowing my distracted mind, it could easily have just poor, you know, faded from memory. But because that poem was read so soon after it happened, it's held. And two or three years later, I was on a month-long solitary retreat at a Thai forest monastery north of Sydney, and a rewriting of Maitreya came to me. And I just need to explain two things before I give it to you. In Australia, we talk about the natural landscape, the uncultivated landscape, as the bush. So it's just the way we talk about it. And also in this part of New South Wales, there were the most wonderful Gymea lilies. And a Gymea lily comes from the Liliaceae family. It's part of the lily family, but it's quite extraordinary. The flowers grow on very long, solid stems, which are 12 or 15 feet high. And then it's a composite flower, so it's right up high, it's a composite flower, and there are small crimson lily flowers. So it's a sort of like a medallion. It's a very heraldic flower. So here's Maitreya with apologies, Maitreya with apologies to Bhante. Lost in the beauties of the bush I see, a Buddha seated under every tree. Each Gymea lily, each eroded granite hill, seems a stately Buddha meditating still. So old this earth, so vast its sky above, they seem like Maitreya, deep in thoughts of love. I can't explain this sense of eminence, of presence, of the Buddha's company. It's not continuously with me, but again and again it is there. It is present. There is a presence, a bond. And one of the lovely things is that, of course, trees are almost everywhere. And in many cultures, certainly in Western culture, but in many cultures, trees are seen as symbols of life. And of course, they were significant in the life of the historical Buddha. He was born outside under a tree. He gained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. And the sal trees burst into unseasonal full flower at his death. And he died under the sal trees, his parinirvana. And of course, much of his life was spent outside. He meditated under trees. He would have sought the shade of the tree when he wasn't actually walking from place to place. And for Australians, this shade of a tree is known to be a great comfort. But certainly in India, the shade of a tree is a real refuge. Of course, it's not an unconditional refuge, but one seeks the shade of a tree when one's out and about. For some centuries after the Buddha's parinirvana, when no aspect of the Buddha's life was depicted in human form, the Buddha's enlightenment was represented by the Bodhi tree. So we'll all be familiar with the different ways that the Buddha was represented before we actually had representations in human form. But the Bodhi tree was certainly one of them, and a sense of the enlightenment story. For me, and I move now on to the fact that I didn't go to El Convento where I was ordained thinking I would ask for the visualization practice of the Buddha Shakyamuni. I was going to ask for Akshobhya. And one morning, just before the private ordinations, we were doing the prostration practice early in the morning, and I suddenly knew in my heart, in mind, that there was a Buddha under each of those gnarled old olive trees in the olive grove behind the monastery, and that there was also Buddhas in the ruined walled gardens. So those of you who remember El Convento were there. It was a sense that, oh yes, here, of course, there's a Buddha under every tree. So I went to Anjali, my private preceptor, and it was possible to change my mind, of course. Soon after I was ordained, I got news from Australia that if I wanted to see my brother alive, I better go. And I had the good fortune to be able to just leave. And I flew back to Australia to a very difficult situation. My brother lived at Nimbin, which Australians will immediately associate with a great deal of dope and alcohol and goodness knows what else. And my brother was part of that scene. So it was in a household where not only was a lot of dope smoked and alcohol drunk, but a lot of meat was eaten, and there were two very noisy dogs, and their meat also was in the fridge. And it was just not an environment that I would, in usual circumstances, have found myself in, but this was, of course, unusual. And it was very difficult for me to meditate. Very jet-lagged to begin with. I was there for about 10 days. And then just these conditions weren't very conducive. But it was the most beautiful natural environment, and I could go and sit in their orchard of maple trees and look across the valley. The orchard, the maple trees were very new, they were very small, they've just been grown. But across the valley there were the most wonderful, what we call snow gum trees, which have long, slender, white trunks and then gum leaf foliage, mostly sort of a dark green. And I just knew there was a Buddha under those trees, and it was that connection that I was able to make every day. I made a point of just leaving the house for a while and going and sitting outside there. So yes, very much gum trees in Australia. And what happened for me that when I did get back to my formal sadhana process, the Buddha was under a gum tree, even in my Tibetan version. So and then it faded, and that felt fine. And of course, we had the lovely image that Parami gave us that comes from Bhante Sangharachitta, of the Sangha in all its manifestations as groves of trees. So there's so many ways that trees can call to us. And finally, here at Wyndham, every second year, Buddhas are found under many trees. And I remember particularly, I think it must have been the combined convention of 2003, and I walked down through the sports field, and the trees here at Wyndham are just exquisite. And it was early morning before meditation, and I walked and I walked and I couldn't believe it. I mean, this Buddha was getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it certainly hadn't been there the night before because I'd been there the night before. And there was Pranaya Paramita under the trees. She manifested overnight. So yes, trees I find very helpful. So I want to go on, and it's very interesting to see what the time is. I'm sorry, I'm going to go over time. To a response to the beautiful. So for me, an empathy for life and a response to the beautiful are deeply interconnected. And I imagine for many of us, perhaps all of us, they are. And of course, there's an enormous amount that I could try and say. I'm just going to pick one thing that for me encompasses the beautiful. I have the good fortune to have a painting of the Buddha Shakyamuni created especially for me by Aloka. Our conversations, which were both face-to-face here in England and then later by email when I returned to Australia, about my imagining of the Buddha were as significant and inspiring in their own way as the finished image itself. And it was the most wonderful conversation that Aloka, you know, really wanted to know. And he'd ask me questions, and sometimes I was quite clear, oh, no, it's not like that. But other things I really had to go away and think about and do myself and think, well, you know, what is it? And the one that I found most amazing and inspiring was he asked me, well, is there a lotus floating in the top of the Buddha's begging bowl? And I was very clear about the begging bowl and it was empty. But I never thought about the lotus or the possibility of a lotus, and it wasn't in the written form of the sadhana as it was given to me. And I said, well, I don't know. And sometime later I got back to him and I said, yes, there is a lotus, but I don't want it represented. I just want the fragrance of a lotus. And I smiled to myself and thought, that will tax him, but of course it didn't tax him at all. And it is absolutely exquisite. For those of you familiar with the Lopez paintings, he has lots of beautiful sort of dots. I'm sure there's a more academic way of saying that, but the fragrance of the lotus as coming out of the begging bowl is exquisitely depicted. And the thing that was particularly surprising to me was not the Gaimiya lilies, which we talked about, and I'd said, I could send you a photograph of Gaimiya lilies, and I got an email back. I was in Australia by that stage, and I got an email back within a couple of hours saying, don't worry, I've been on the web, wacky flowers. So there was a lovely response. So they're there, and the Buddha sits under a Bodhi tree, but the trees in the background have turned into gum trees, which is something I hadn't asked for, but it's happened. And the thing that I hadn't even thought about and we hadn't discussed was the Buddha's aura. And it's beautifully depicted, very subtly done. I mean, when it's out around the Buddha's head, it's very clear and golden. But it rises out of his heart centre and comes round. And that's something that's engaged me a great deal. And I could say more, but I won't, because I think I will just say, this is an experience I had. We were talking about the Buddha's face, and I said to a loka that I had the most beautiful Japanese print, just of a Buddha head. And when I got back to Australia, I would get it photographed and sent to him, which I did. And he got back to me and said, this is one of the most famous bits of Japanese Buddhist iconography. He recognised it immediately. And how I'd come by that print is one of the things that I go back to now when I think about a bond, what it was within me. As a 21-year-old, I went to India to collect the research material for a BA honours thesis in Indian history in the British Raj period. And I had done that work, and I still had some time, and I'd done some sightseeing. And I got myself to Varanasi, and I was absolutely peopled out. And I was in a tourist bungalow, a government tourist bungalow, so lots of other English-speaking tourists were there. And I said to a couple of people, I'd love to go and spend a totally quiet day somewhere. And one of them said, why don't you go to Sarnath? And so I found out how you did it, and I got there. And I had done some Indian history and culture in my undergraduate degree. But my introduction to Buddhism, I now look back on and think, I think it must have been the perfection of wisdom texts, because I remember they just didn't hit me at all. And being an arrogant young academic or aspiring academic student, I just sort of thought, philosophically that's very clever. But it hadn't hit me. So I went to Sarnath with no real feeling for Buddhism or the Dharma at all. And I just had one of those most extraordinary experiences. I sat under a tree and the wonderful stupas were there. But there was also an Indian man with two white oxen, and they were pulling one of those lawn cutting or grass cutting machines that sort of go click, 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 click. And he just moved up and down in a very rhythmic way. And I just don't know where the time went. But about 5 hours later, I sort of thought, perhaps I should go find some lunch. Perhaps I should go back to Varanasi. And a great sense of calm, a great sense of inner peace. There was very few shops or anything there. I mean, this was in the 1960s sometime, I can't remember when. And but there were some, and I went looking for something that would be a memento, much more than a memento, a guide to this experience, and found this print and bought it. And I had it for over 22, 23 years. And when I first found the FWBO in Sydney and people talked about it was a good idea to make your own shrine, I suddenly remembered that print. And I found it. It was amazing. I'm not somebody that keeps very much, but I hadn't thrown it out. And the silverfish had got to it, but only to the mound, so I had it reframed. And I don't see it in Aloka's face, but I feel the peace. I was very taken with Kamala Sheila's reporting in the July Shabda. He there talked a little bit about Manjushra, and he then went on to talk about his solitary that he had just come off. And he says this about the Buddha. "He's great, yet I still find I cannot strongly revere the historical Buddha. It's easy to believe he existed and was the noblest and wisest of us yet. But the atmosphere I get of it is still historical, a quality more about interest and curiosity, about what this person did and was, rather than who and what the Buddha is. The Buddha simply pointed the way. My image of him doesn't contain the uneasy sense that right now he might make me burst out of my armoured view of self and substance. With Avalokiteshvara or Tara or Manjushri, you feel like they could reach out and shake you. They are not in the past. They don't exist in any way I can conceive." The Buddha discovered that seemingly scary reality quite beyond himself, the Dharmakaya, the Dharmanyama. For that, I feel reverence and awe. So that's quoting Kamala Sheila. And it was a lovely way for me to think about, well, you know, how would I respond to Kamala Sheila from my own perspective? So I'll just pick up 3 points. Kamala Sheila says, "The Buddha simply pointed the way. For me, he lived the way, exemplified the way, was the way. The Buddha was born as we are born. What the Buddha overcame, we too can overcome. What the Buddha attained, we too can attain." And then Kamala Sheila goes on and says, "With Avalokiteshvara or Tara or Manjushri, they are not in the past. They don't exist in any way I can conceive. For me, the Buddha is not only a past historical figure, the Nirmanakaya. He too is here, but not in any way I can conceive. His words, the Dharma, and his sense presence do momentarily shake me out of my armoured view of self and substance." And finally, "The Buddha discovered that seemingly scary reality quite beyond himself, the Dharmakaya, the Dharmanyama." For me, the final line of one of Bhante's poems has always resonated. "My place is at thy feet." And sometimes those feet are very much the fleshly feet, the dusty fleshly feet of somebody who walked and walked through northeastern India. Sometimes those feet are the stone or wooden feet or marble feet of a beautiful rupa, or the golden feet. And sometimes they're the empty footprints, symbols of Anatman, of Shunyata. And there are verses in the Dharma, and certainly Vajratara, with you And I haven't looked these up, so they're not word perfect, but I have a real confidence in the meaning is there. She who knows me by my face and voice does not know me, the Buddha. She who knows me by the Dharma knows the Buddha. And a second one. She who sees Paticca-samuppada sees the Dharma. She who sees the Dharma sees the Buddha. I want to finish with a prayer. It's in three parts. I offer to thee, the Blessed One, the Buddha Shakyamuni, this awakening heart-mind in this old working body, my love and my desire to realize your word, the Dharma. May I see you, the Buddha, the Dharmakaya, the Sambhogakaya, the Vipanakaya. And I pray that you may fill all sentient beings with thy grace. May we all uncover, embody, and express Buddha nature as bodhicitta. May the bodhicitta be in our hearts and in our understanding. May the bodhicitta be in our eyes and in our looking. May the bodhicitta be in our ears and in our hearing. May the bodhicitta be in our noses and in our sense of smell. May the bodhicitta be in our mouths and in our taste and speech. May the bodhicitta be in our bodies and in our touch and feeling. May the bodhicitta be in our heart minds and in our awareness and awakening. May the Buddha Shakyamuni bless us. May all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas bless us, so that the bodhicitta awakens in our hearts. Wisdom and compassion arise, and we can be of benefit to all sentient beings.